From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Senator Lindsey Graham defends his health care reform bill by going after single-payer advocates.
I will do everything I can to stop and put a stake in the heart of single-payer health care. You don't like Obamacare. You don't think it's big government enough. I'm here to stop you.
Also today...
You know, some owner's going to do that. He's going to say, that guy that disrespects our flag, he's fired.
That was President Trump on Friday. We'll talk about how NFL players responded on Sunday and the impact of this clash between sports and politics. Plus, are smartphones destroying a generation?
2012 is the year when the majority of Americans got a smartphone. Between 2011 and 2015, there's this big increase in mental health issues among teens.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Capitol Hill, passionate protest and a scene that lays bare just how much is on the line when it comes to the latest health care reform bill from Senate Republicans. Just an hour ago, Senator Orrin Hatch, chair of the Finance Committee, attempted to gavel in the first hearing on the Graham-Cassidy bill.
I'd like to welcome everyone, and I do mean everyone. Well, if we're going...
And as you hear, immediately protesters inside and outside the hearing room began chanting.
If you want a hearing, you better shut up. Okay, let's get.
Yeah, well, we'll let the police take care of this, Hatch said as he left, according to reporters in the room. And Capitol Police began arresting people, some in wheelchairs, others with white canes. The hearing was eventually gaveled back in, and first witness, Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, who defended his bill.
Washington is wired when it comes to health care. Everybody opposing this bill is a big winner of Obamacare, and my goal is to get the money and power out of Washington closer to where people live so they'll have a voice about the most important thing in their life.
Joining me now from Washington is Noam Levy, national health care reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi there.
Hi.
So first of all, tell us more about the Senate Finance Committee hearing today, the first one on Graham-Cassidy. How's it been going since they were able to gavel back in?
Well, this is, as you said, the first, and it will be the only hearing, most likely, on this piece of legislation if the Senate votes this week. It has been, as you noted, contentious. There were protesters this morning, this afternoon, in the hearing room, and the chairman was forced to take a break and allow the Capitol Police to clear the hearing room. Outside the hearing room were long lines of people waiting to get in, so there's a lot of passion around this issue.
Absolutely. And we even heard passion there from Senator Lindsey Graham himself defending the bill. Now, some changes have been made to Graham-Cassidy, and those changes were unveiled this morning. What are they, and what are they designed to do?
So it's important to understand sort of how sweeping Graham-Cassidy is to begin with. The legislation proposes to do a number of things, including allowing states much more leeway to waive a number of the consumer protections that were in the Affordable Care Act that President Obama signed in 2010. And secondly, to restructure the way hundreds of billions of dollars of federal health care assistance to states is distributed. The net impact of that, of those proposals, according to every independent analysis and assessment by physician groups, patient advocates, and others, is that most likely it will result in higher costs for people with pre-existing medical conditions and substantial cuts to healthcare safety nets in a number of states, particularly those that expanded coverage under the Affordable Care Act.
Right, and just to reinforce your point there, Noam. I mean, we're seeing near unified opposition to this bill from the healthcare sector writ large. As you mentioned, everyone from insurers, hospital groups, the American Medical Association, but also the Medicaid directors in all 50 states. Right.
Well, the board of the Medicaid directors, that's right, former state insurance commissioners, Democrats and Republicans. I've been covering Washington for nearly a dozen years. I've never seen a piece of legislation engender this level of unified resistance from people who are actually involved in the policy of this of a piece of legislation. Essentially, the only people at this point who are arguing that this is good for the American healthcare system are the bill's authors and some conservative activists.
Okay, interesting. Now, this revised version of the bill that we saw this morning, though, is trying to win over some key votes that could still see the Senate bill pass. And those votes, of course, are from both Maine and Alaska, Senators Murkowski and Collins. And the new version, if I understand correctly, would send more money to Alaska and Maine. Do we have any sense that it might budge their votes?
Not yet. You know, the problem that this proposal, like all of the repeal proposals by Republicans this year, has always been that in order to satisfy the most conservative members of the Republican caucus, the bill has had the repeal proposals have had to deregulate insurance and cut federal spending as much as possible. The problem, of course, is that that has very real consequences in a lot of states, and a lot of Republican governors have opposed this, and some more centrist Republican lawmakers have been very queasy about that those level of cuts. So what Senators Graham and Cassidy have been doing is trying to make changes that will woo some more centrist Republicans like Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Hence, a traditional congressional technique of sending more money to those states,
yep,
while at the same time wooing the most conservative opponents of this proposal, which keeps too much of the current law, according to lawmakers like Rand Paul of Kentucky and Ted Cruz of Texas.
Right. So if I can just jump in here, Noam, from what I understand, Rand Paul is still saying that he's a hard no on this for exactly the reasons that you just said. And John McCain hasn't changed from his today so far, hasn't changed from the no position he put out a couple of days ago. But healthcare, or I should say health advocates, people who are concerned about Graham Cassidy, are still saying that they're concerned that this bill could pass. Now, what's going on in Washington that even though we've got a couple of folks saying no and really only need one or two more votes, perhaps from Murkowski or Collins, to kill this bill, why are people still so concerned?
Well, I think there are two reasons. Number one, there was an assumption over the summer that this push to roll back the Affordable Care Act was dead. And it sort of came roaring back out of nowhere about 10 days ago. And so there is a level of anxiety on the part of patient advocates, people in the physician community, state leaders, et cetera, that it's impossible to say for sure that this push will end. The other dynamic here is that while the Senate has a September 30th deadline, after which the Senate Republicans can no longer use a special procedure that allows them to pass repeal legislation with only 50 votes. While that authorization to use that procedure expires on September 30th, there's nothing that would prevent congressional Republicans from changing the rules going forward to allow this again. So I think there's a lot of anxiety on the part of people in the healthcare system that this push to repeal the Affordable Care Act won't end no matter what happens this week.
Wow. Well, we will definitely keep our eye on it because this is changing from moment to moment. Noam Levy, national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times, speaking to us from Washington. Thank you so very much.
Good to be with you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, a bit earlier today at the White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders defended President Donald Trump and his decision on Friday in Alabama to stir his base by going after NFL players who don't stand during the national anthem. Here's Sanders.
I think that it's always appropriate for the President of the United States to defend our flag, to defend the national anthem, and to defend the men and women who fought and died to defend it.
And as a reminder, here's exactly what the president said on Friday. Now, a warning, the president used some language that we usually don't air.
We're proud of our country. We respect our flag. Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired.
Well, some players and teams responded on Sunday with even bigger protests. About 30 New England Patriots, including Tom Brady, either knelt or linked arms in solidarity. Some teams refused to take the field at all during the national anthem. Here's Miami Dolphins safety Michael Thomas. He spoke to reporters yesterday about why he protested what the president had to say.
Yeah, I took it personally, but at the same time, like I said in my Twitter post, it's bigger than me, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's bigger than me. I got a daughter. She's going to have to live in this world. You know what I'm saying? And I'm going to do whatever I got to do to make sure, you know, she can look at my dad, look at her dad and be like, hey, you did something. You tried to make a change. You feel me?
That's right.
Well, let's get some response from across the board, including from you. What do you think about the protest? What do you think about what the president had to say? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. If you were at Gillette to watch the Patriots, what did you make of what happened there? Again, 800-423-8255. Joining us now is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hi, Shira.
Hello, Meghna.
Also with us is Matt Light. Matt was an offensive lineman for the Patriots from 2001 to 2011, a member of three Super Bowl championship teams. Matt Light, welcome to you.
Hello, hello.
It's really great to have you. Shira, first of all, let me start with you and just give us sort of a roundup about what happened around the league this weekend on Sunday.
Well, basically, you had all teams showing their solidarity, or basically showing that they were not going to stand for what Trump had said in one way or another. Some teams decided to all lock arms along the sideline. Some players in small groups knelt along the sidelines. You also had some players raising fists. And then there were the Seattle Seahawks and the Tennessee Titans, who actually spent while the national anthem was playing, they stayed inside the locker room. So there were a variety of protests, silent protests during the singing of the national anthem in arenas across the country. And players said it was a show of unity as well as a show that they would not be disrespected by President Trump.
Okay. And so, Matt, after watching the demonstration at the Pats game yesterday, how did you feel about it?
Well, I was very disappointed, and I was disappointed because I was standing in a room in a luxury box at the stadium with a SEAL Team 6 member and the widow of a SEAL Team 6 member, as well as a 91-year-old veteran who served this country for 10 years. And I'll tell you, it was a much different tone in that room. And I think that what we need to do is have real conversations regarding what it is we're talking about, because for the men that were in that room and the women that were in that room, it wasn't about racism. It was about respecting our country. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a much different conversation than the one that some people want to lead others down.
Well, so Matt, tell me more about what they were saying, because I'm seeing, look, the United States military is huge. Millions of members, people connected to the military. So there's no one opinion here. Because I've been also seeing people, you know, members of the military, family members speaking out saying, you know, my mother or my father, my brother or sister or myself, we served in order to protect people's right in America to have their say on what they have to say. And in fact, they, in that sense, we're feeling very supportive of Colin Kaepernick and others who choose not to stand during the anthem.
Well, listen, we can talk about the ones or twos, but I'll tell you, there were about 70,000 people that were on their feet in that stadium and didn't respect the, you know, what these guys were doing. And here's why. Our country stands for honor and freedom and sacrifice and respect. And there's nothing that signifies that more than the time that we take, the very little time that we take as Americans, when there's a traditional moment, like at a football game, to start it off, where we sing the national anthem and we stand and we salute the flag, or we put, you know, a hand across our chest. That is something very important in this country that we can't lose sight of. Now, listen.
Hey, I totally agree with you about the things that are represented in that flag. But when you said freedom, does that not include the freedom to be critical of things that, actions, systems that are very harmful to some Americans?
Well, I would challenge you to this. If that's your train of thought, at what point could you not get creative enough to do it in another way that doesn't involve disrespecting millions of Americans that serve their country? At what point can you not? I mean, to me, it's almost the same as the F word being used in comedies. Can they not come up with something better? Can they not be a little bit more creative? These guys have an unbelievable platform. I was in the locker room for 11 years. I know how passionate these guys are about different things, including things that affect them on a very personal level. And they have the ability to talk and voice their concerns and say things at a number of different times throughout the week, throughout the year, and people will listen. And I hope that they have those real conversations, because we need that
yes.
in this country.
Great point. Shira, come on in back in.
And if I were to just kind of summarize what some of the players were saying, because the players did note that they meant no disrespect to the military, and they did acknowledge they have this tremendous platform to address social injustice and racial inequality. But the problem is no one is listening, and they felt that, or that they aren't listening close enough, and they felt that this was the biggest and best platform they could use, the national anthem protest. Plus, in a way, President Trump instigated this on Friday night by his words at the Alabama rally, and they felt that they needed to take some immediate action and really show the president basically that they were not going to be disrespected. And more than that, that they were not going to have their words twisted, because I think what's important is, yes, people are portraying this as a disrespect to the military, and some military members may have felt disrespected. But the statements that have been released by teams as well as by individual players such as Devin McCourty, who plays for the Patriots, Devin McCourty has said, listen, I meant no disrespect to the military. I have family in the military. And there have been not one, not two, but several, maybe even a dozen players who have come out and said, listen, I have family members in the military. There's nobody I respect more and think does a better job and is more fearless and brave in protecting our freedoms than the servicemen and women of this country. And you should not conflate, misconstrue what was done here today during the national anthem as any in any way disrespect of the military.
Hey, Matt, so well, what's
I can,
your – yeah, go ahead.
You this much, though. Yeah. I can promise you this much, that – the military men and women that I was at least in a room with that have credentials that speak for themselves don't really care if you start out with all due respect, okay? Because respect is something that's earned. Respect isn't just given, right? I stress to you that if the President of the United States says that standing and saluting the flag is important to show respect to the men and women who serve this country and what we stand for, if you want to turn that into a racist remark, I think you're out of your mind, and I think you're completely off base. Again, this conversation isn't about race. This isn't black and white. These are actions. If you choose to act a certain way, knowing that you're going to be upsetting a lot of people, and you know that there's another way to do it, and there are plenty of ways to do it, do it with your time. Do it with your resources. Actually get out there and have a message. If they would have said, I'm taking a knee because I believe in this, they didn't all do that. You know that. I know that. They don't have a platform unless they truly speak to what it is they believe in. And that's what needs to happen. And that's what I encourage. And I hope that that is what comes out of this.
So, Matt, let me say, I hear your passion. And I think your point about the platform that NFL players and the voice that they have is an excellent point. But I really struggle when I hear you say that you don't think this is about racism, because I think it is. I mean, what the president of the United States has a 2-year-long history of making issues out of this whenever African-Americans speak out. You know, he himself disrespected the military during his campaign when he said, hey, I know better than the generals how to solve the problem in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, that's disrespectful. He's never served a day in his life. So I just feel like there's so much that's being heaped on top of things here. But do you really think that race isn't part of the issue here?
Well, I can tell you this much. Again, it wasn't race wasn't any part of the equation when it comes to the men and women that were in that suite that I stood with.
Yeah,
I don't ever hear it. Look, racism has been a part of America way before Donald Trump. if you guys want to keep going back to Trump and that's the platform and that's what you want to hang your hat on.
Well, I'm only going back to it because he's the president of the United States right now.
He is the president of the United States. And the president of the United States made a very simple, very straightforward comment that kneeling for the flag disrespects the men and women that serve this country. I don't need to defend President Trump. I don't agree with how he does a lot of things that he does. I'm not the president, and I don't want to be the president. But he is, and he made a very clear statement that had nothing to do with race.
Shira, what's your thought?
Well, I just think one of the things, and I'll go back to what some of the players were saying post-game, both black and white, that as a group they felt disrespected by when President Trump effectively called those who protested, quote unquote, son of a bitch, end quote. So what they were saying is here he is so quick to condemn NFL players for the silent protests they were holding during national anthems, and yet it takes him forever to condemn white supremacists and neo-Nazis. And that was part of the problem, and quite frankly, part of the reason that some players said they were going to either take a knee or link arms or raise a fist to basically combat what Trump had said.
That's Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter. We're also joined today by Matt Light, former New England Patriot as well. We got a lot of calls here, so let's take a couple of them. I'll roll through them as quickly as possible. Brendan's calling from Framingham. You're on the air, Brendan. Hello, Brendan. You there? All right, let's go to Beverly. Rama's calling from Beverly. You're on the line.
Yes, hi, and thank you for taking my call. I get goosebumps when I hear the national anthem. I stand up even if I'm watching it at my house. I sometimes cry. But I will fight tooth and nail for those guys' right to kneel and to express their opinion. They have been dissed so bad that Trump did call them SOBs. Okay, Matt? Sure, I agree with everything you're saying. Matt, I think you got blinders on. I think you're way off base. You know a lot of African-American people, a lot of African-American football players, and I think you got blinders on. It's really got me going here. I think we really have to really, really respect their right. And those people sitting with you in that booth should have been thanking them, should have been acknowledging them, because they fought for that right. They didn't fight for go kill people. They fought for the right for us to be free. Okay, and they're expressing their freedom. They're expressing their right. They've been dissed by President Trump. Cops have been killing black people all over the country. That's what they're protesting. It's nothing to do with the military. Matt, you're way off base.
Rama, thank you for your call. Matt, you want to respond?
Yeah, listen, again, I encourage you that if you want to do something to make a difference in the world, go out and do something. If you want to talk about other people doing things the wrong way, go out and do something. If you want to affect real change, get off the couch and off your social media platforms and stand up for something. Because taking a knee to just join the group hasn't done anything yet. I mean,
it's gotten us all to talk about it at the very least. We're all talking.
Yeah, you're right. We are talking about it. And listen, we've been talking about things for a long time. I'm sure that President Obama talked about stopping all the violence in Chicago with all the rest of his politicians for a long time. Has it happened yet? No. Let me tell you what does work, okay? Because I have dedicated myself to helping young people. And obviously, race doesn't come into the equation. And I get up every day with a mission to do my part to give back. Maybe your part isn't the same. Maybe you do it financially. Maybe you do it by being there and comforting other people. But I'm going to tell you what, if you just want to talk about it, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to change. My actions speak very loudly. My record is very clear. I have a great conscience. What I'm talking about is not about race. What I'm talking about is paying respect to the men and women who have given up their lives. If your agenda is more important than that, then you are the one that's off base. And I promise you it is not me, and I have more Americans that can stand for that than anybody that will call into NPR to have a conversation about talking about our feelings instead of getting up and actually doing something.
So, Matt, look, I hear you completely. And first of all, I want to say that I am utterly grateful that you are on with us to talk, but I just would ask that you don't make any presumptions about folks listening and the actions that they are or aren't taking on behalf of causes they really believe in their community, because I think you'd find that contrary to maybe some stereotypes, that a lot of public radio listeners, they're across the board politically, and they're very active in their communities.
So
we can all come together on that here.
I tune into NPR every day. You're talking to one of them. I don't presume anything of anyone. I'm just encouraging those that have something to say to go beyond talking about it. It's time to start doing something.
I hear you. I want to let Shira. I have one more question for both you and Shira, but let me give Shira first crack at it. Just to bring us back to the NFL, what impact could this have, if any, on the NFL? Sports and politics are always a volatile mix. What does this moment say?
Well, I think it says, first of all, that, these protests aren't going to let up. It's interesting. It's been estimated that a reported 300 players participated in some way. And prior to that, there had been about 12 or 14 players who had been part of the kneeling. So I think, first of all, it's gathering momentum. And Trump has, instead of tamping it down, kind of galvanized the NFL. And I think the NFL is going to have to do some soul searching. You would like to, you saw owners linking arms with their players. And I would like to see that be one of the outcomes of what's going to happen here, which is some soul searching on the part of the NFL. And as Matt says, to take the talk and turn it into action.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're actually out of time with that. Shira Springer, WBR Sports and Society reporter, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Matt Light, offensive lineman, former offensive lineman with the Patriots, member of 3 Super Bowl championship teams. Matt, thank you so very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, and have a great day.
And listeners, we know we couldn't get a lot of you on the air, but go to our website, radioboston.org, and let us know what you think, or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Smartphones are ruining our children's mental health. Well, that may sound alarmist, but that's exactly the alarm bell that Jean Twenge is ringing in her new book, iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. She's a professor of psychology at San Diego State University, and she joins us from San Diego. Jean Twenge, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. And, we have a ton of listeners in our audience who may be driving their kids home from school right now, so I would love to know what they think. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, if you have some thoughts about smartphones and your kids. So, Jean, if I just may ask, your book and your article in the Atlantic Monthly has received an enormous amount of response. I think it's passed through my various social media feeds dozens of times. In a nutshell, what's your argument? Are you concerned about smartphones and young kids, not so much millennials, but the generation coming up right behind them?
Yeah, so that's iGen, those born 1995 and later, they're the first generation to spend their entire adolescence with a smartphone. So I've been doing work on differences among generations for about 25 years. And right around 2012, I started to notice some sudden changes in these really big national surveys filled out by teens every year. And right around that time, more teens started to say that they felt useless, that they felt like they couldn't do anything right. These are classic symptoms of depression. More started to say that they felt lonely and left out. Fewer were saying that they were happy. And then these trends showed up in other very large, big surveys. A national screening study showed a big increase in clinical-level depression. The suicide rate for teens has doubled or tripled among some age groups in the past 10 years. And it just so happens 2012 is the year that the percentage of Americans with a smartphone crossed 50%. So that's what got me started thinking maybe there's a connection here.
Okay, so help me understand something, because when you said that the numbers and the surveys were showing this, is this the Monitoring the Future survey series that you're talking about?
So in the first few examples, yes, that's Monitoring the Future. Then there's the National Screening Study for Clinical Level Depression. And then there's the CDC data on the suicide rate.
I see. So as you know, I mean, you've received an enormous amount of response for your book and your article. And there are some people out there who are saying, well, you know, their first concern is that the standard correlation does not equal causation. So how can you say that it's smartphones per se?
Right.
That are causing these shifts?
Yeah, so that's always the challenge in doing work on cultural trends and generational trends. You can document the changes. So it's extremely clear that this generation is suffering from more mental health issues than teens were just 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But then the question is why? So the timing lines up. We know that. But then the question is, okay, is increased screen time linked to mental health issues? So it is in correlational data. Then the next question is, well, that's a correlation. Maybe the causation goes the other way. Maybe teens who are unhappy then, say, spend more time on social media rather than social media leading to unhappiness. But there's three other studies that looked carefully at that that kind of rule out that explanation of unhappiness leading to more use. Mm-hmm. So two followed people over time and found that more social media use led to more unhappiness, but not vice versa. Another was a true experiment, randomly assigned people to either give up Facebook for a week or not, and found that those who gave up Facebook ended the week happier, less depressed, and less lonely. Yeah. So no, it is not 100% definitive, but it's a fairly large amount of evidence pointing in that direction that, okay, these are things that are linked among individuals and the timing lines up.
Yeah, so there's this challenge, right, of saying, okay, well, so the data are pointing us to more some more interesting and deeper questions. Like, is it something fundamental to the smartphone? Is it something fundamental to the social media that people are accessing via the smartphone? Or as one reviewer, actually a couple of reviewers were pointing to, like maybe it isn't so much kids' use of smartphones, but adult use, and that the kids are fighting for attention, trying to get their parents' attention. So like, how do we understand sort of where the next level of analysis should be in terms of these changes that we're seeing?
Yeah, so is it the parents not paying attention to the kids? Well, maybe, but we know for sure that the teens who are spending more time with screens are showing more mental health issues. You know, plus, I think you have to consider the big picture here in terms of, okay, if we think this, there might be a connection here, what should we do? Well, the good news is the connection doesn't show up until more than 2 hours a day or more of use. So it doesn't mean we need to be taking those smartphones completely out of kids' hands. That's how they socialize these days. But if they're using it an excessive amount, most teens, by most surveys, 6 to 8 hours a day during their leisure time. So there's definitely room for improvement here. And I think the other part is if they're using it that long, and this shows up in the overtime data too, they have less time to see their friends in person. And we know that spending time with other people face-to-face in social interaction, that is linked to better mental health. So it could be just that, not even the screens themselves. Even if we say, okay, we're going to call screens a neutral, they're taking up so much time that teens don't have the time anymore to go out with their friends, to just hang out, to go to the mall, to go to a movie together.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, that's linked to mental health.
So this is really interesting because a couple of years ago we had Sherry Turkle on, MIT researcher. You know, she's written a lot about technology and social media and human interactions. And you know, she was talking to us about how, yeah, it's true, young people do have their phones on with them a lot, but in a way they're socializing together with their phones. So maybe it's unclear in terms of how much that face-to-face contact has been reduced, or do you have other data about that?
There's very good data on that. So that's also from Monitoring the Future. So the amount of time the number of times a week that teens go out without their parents plummeted, especially after 2010. The percentage who get together with their friends informally every day has also just completely tanked. And then pretty much everything across the board that teens do to get together with their friends and hang out with them, riding around in a car, going to a movie, going to a mall, iGen teens, those in the 2010s, do that less than teens just 10 years ago.
Hmm. So there's another aspect of what you wrote that's really caught a lot of people's attention. And I'm wondering if you could help me or help us understand it. Because as you're saying, there's like reduction, you see evidence of reduction of interaction. Also, I think you wrote about how kids are not getting their driver's licenses necessarily at the same age, how alcohol consumption has gone down and things like that. And so there was a couple factors in there which made me think, actually, maybe that's not such a bad thing.
It's not. It's absolutely not. Well, the driver's license and drinking alcohol are part of a larger trend that is only perhaps partially due to smartphones, because it's been going on since the 90s. So smartphones can't be the primary cause. So iGen teens, by their senior year in high school, less likely to have the driver's license, work at a paid job, go out without their parents, date, have sex, and drink alcohol. So what all those things have in common, it's not are they all bad or are they all good. What they have in common is these are all things that adults do and children don't. So iGen is taking longer to grow up, probably because of larger cultural trends towards smaller families, the way the economy has changed, that people need more years of education. It's a lot of different trends. Now, those trends did accelerate in the last 10 years, so the smartphone might have a role to play later on, but those are caused by a bigger trend.
Yeah. So I'm going to, full disclosure here, I'm the parent of two. They're on the much younger end of things. They're still in their single digits. So this is something I think about all the time. And I have to say, on the one hand, I see the absolute power of technology, right? Whether it's smartphone or not, in terms of giving kids access to the world of knowledge. And I see how young people use it. It is deeply empowering. And I admire their facility with it. On the other hand, and listeners, you can call 800-423-8255 and tell me how I'm wrong about this. But like emotionally, I kind of freak out, right? Because I see how much kids are attached to their phones. And when my kids don't have them yet, but when I go home, I try to put mine in a cabinet, put it away from them. And I have a hard time keeping it in the cabinet because of my own dependency on it. So, I feel like we have a clash here between parental emotional reaction to how they see their children using technology versus, I think, what still may be an unsettled or inconclusive understanding of what the long-term effects are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Well, I have three kids myself. They are 10, 7, and 5. Well, the average age for kids to get their first smartphone these days is 10. Which is very, very young. And these mental health effects tend to show up the most strongly in the younger teens. So this research has definitely informed what I am doing and will do with my own kids, which is to put off getting a smartphone until they're probably 14 or so. We'll see how it goes. But then, you know, when I analyzed some of this data, I made a graph for the book of the correlation between happiness and activities. Pretty much every screen activity was linked to less happiness. Pretty much everything you can do not on a screen, get together with friends, go to religious services, play sports or exercise, even do homework. All of those were linked to more happiness. When I made that graph and saw how stark that was right in front of me, I got up from my seat, took my kids' tablets, because we'd gotten them each their own tablet, and shoved them in the back of my dresser drawer. Huh. I was kind of shocked that they didn't even really noticed that much. They ended up doing other things. They would go outside. They would draw. They would fight with each other. They would do other things. And it has really helped, because when they had their own tablet and it was time to go to bed or time to leave to go somewhere or do something else, then they would cry. They didn't like having that taken away. But when it's time to close the book or stop drawing or stop playing outside, it's an easier transition. It's not as addictive.
Yeah.
So that helps too.
Well, I'm speaking with Jean Twenge, and I'm sorry that I mispronounced your name earlier. My apologies.
I'm used to it.
My last name is Chakrabarty. Tell me about it.
Yeah, right.
She's author of iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Give us a call with your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And I'm especially looking forward to hearing from people out there who think that maybe we're off base in this conversation and that technology is not a problem at all and they see only upside for their kids. Again, 800-423-8255. Let's go to Mike. He's calling from Cohasset. You're on the air, Mike.
Hey, Magna. Hey, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, no, the article is incredibly eye-opening in the sense that as an Apple Distinguished Educator, we've been focused on creating multimedia projects that enable kids to collaborate together interpersonally to create using technology. And so what I've seen is that not only is the thinking strategies and the creativity and the interpersonal relationships really taking off, they're getting together after school to collaborate and create these projects just for the fun of it that aren't homework, but that get to all of these critical 21st century skills. And so I'd be interested to hear, A, because the upside of it, if you guys have any suggestions for what teachers can do to help kids become more aware of how they use technology as opposed to just whether or not, you know, it's good or bad.
Mike, great question. Thank you for your call. Mm-hmm. Jean, your thoughts?
Yeah. So, you know, technology is great. Smartphones are great. So they are a tool that we can use. So when it comes to students working together in a multimedia project, it's clearly one of the benefits of this technology. The downside is when you have the teen who done with homework and then the rest of the evening and into the night is on that phone. And that's a very, very common story of that, you know, 6 hours a day or more of use. And they're doing that instead of doing these things that are more beneficial for their mental health, their social skills, their academic skills. Because you have to think about what are most teens doing when they're on the phone? They're usually not looking up information. They're usually not reading books or magazine articles. We know that they're not from these surveys. Instead, it's almost all communication with friends electronically and entertainment.
So, Jean, let me just jump in here because hearing what you said, it feels to me that the issue perhaps isn't so much the smartphone, but rather parenting and society, because I imagine that there are many people out there, many in communities, for example, where perhaps it's possible that the phone is filling in a void that's left by a lack of the kind of community activities, sports, faith communities, volunteer organizations, what have you, the kind of stuff that young people might have had easier access to in the past, and for whatever reason now, they don't.
Well, maybe. I mean, sports and exercise is down by just a little bit. Community service is either unchanged or up, depending on which age group you're looking at. Religious services, yes, that's definitely down among teens. But the stuff that's gone down the most is very informal. It's things like just going out or hanging out with your friends informally, which you can do at home. That's what's really changed the most. So although there's some of that, a lot of it is just many teens don't feel the need to get together with their friends in person. And because the norm has shifted to communicate electronically, the problem is there's been this assumption that electronic communication is just as good as face-to-face communication. I think it's pretty clear from the literature that it is not as good.
All right. Let's take a call from Lisa. She's calling from Roxbury. You're on the air, Lisa.
Hi, I'm a middle school teacher in Roxbury, and I collect phones daily for two reasons. One, so that students aren't using them while we're having academic time, but also because the anxiety of them having their phone in their pocket and constantly thinking that they need to check how many likes they have or don't have, lack thereof, it creates this anxiety, and the depression you talk about, it's so evident. You know, I teach the tough years of the 12, 13, and 14, and what I've seen in the past 14 years of teaching is the decline in self-confidence in class, self-confidence just in life in general. And I guess where I have a question is, are there some developments that you know of interventions that parents can do, teachers can do? Maybe it's with social media awareness or media awareness, but basically something that can kind of slow those staggering numbers down of kids that are dealing with depression from being attached to their phones.
Lisa, thank you so much for your call. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's right. I mean, this is what's showing up, not just the mental health issues, but anxiety, depression, self-confidence, self-esteem has gone down. Life satisfaction has really gone down. They are less confident in the classroom. And there's a study that does exactly what she's describing. When people have their phone in their pocket or on the table, if they know it's there, but they can't check it, anxiety just goes up and up and up. And that's college students. That's not even middle school students. So in terms of interventions, I think we do have to think about that, because even though the data's not definitive. We can't take that chance that smartphones are playing a role in this really disturbing rise in mental health issues. So for parents, you can put an app on your teen's phone that can limit the amount of time they spend on, say, social media, that can shut down that phone at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night so they can get a good night's sleep. Just limiting this, yes, having them still do it, but especially for older teens, giving them a little more freedom. But for middle school, that's where the mental health effects are really strong.
So let me ask you, because I actually hear a couple of things in what you just said, and I want to tease them apart for a second, because, I mean, absolutely, I'm going to get a neurologist in here next time to talk to us about what the biochemical effects are on a young brain of constantly having a device lighting up and pinging next to you. I mean, part of me feels like it's a lot like, a slot machine constantly pinging.
That's pretty much what it's like, right? According to most of the studies.
The dopamine squirt, right?
Yes.
That your brain gets.
Right.
That's one thing. But on the other hand, you know, hearing about the anxiety that we're linking to it, I also wonder how much the anxiety or communication about depression has to do with the fact that positively we as a society have gotten a lot better about talking about mental health issues. We screen for it. We, you know, there's a language for it. It's not sort of swept under the rug anymore. Is it possible at all that, you know, a generation that we've spent trying to get better and more open-minded about mental health issues is actually, I don't know, getting kids to demonstrate some of those same symptoms? I mean, is that possible at all?
With this type of data, it's highly unlikely.
Okay.
So first, that can't possibly explain the suicide rate. That's
right.
A behavior.
Right.
Second, these national screening studies do a very good job of making sure that these responses are anonymous. Monitor in the Future was designed to pick up on drug and alcohol use, even illegal drugs, among teens. So they take every possible step to say, look, this is anonymous. It's not going to be linked up. And this increase in the mental health issues was very sudden. It didn't like slowly rise in a way you might expect if there was like increased acceptance or something. It just suddenly shoots upward right around the time the majority of Americans got a smartphone. So I think it's very unlikely that that's the explanation.
I want to take another call here quickly. But before we go further, just I want to fact check something with you, because someone who wrote quite a critical review of your book said that you wrote a 2010 paper that said that the Monitoring the Future data set doesn't measure anxiety or depression. So it's impossible to test changes in mental health using those data.
That's an easy one. I was wrong. The data set has more than 1,000 questions in it, and it turns out the measure of depressive symptoms is on the very last form, which doesn't have a lot of forms on it. It doesn't have a lot of questions on it, and I hadn't fully explored the data set at the point that I wrote that, when I had only been working with the data set for a few months.
Let's take one more call here. We've just got 2 minutes left. Glenn is calling from Arlington. You're on the air, Glenn.
Hi. I'm listening to this. I get the sense of a sort of us versus them attitude of adults versus youth. And as a volunteer working with a church group for many years, I found that there's a lot of untapped resource in asking young people themselves to talk about what they see as the issues, because they can articulate this much better if we give them a chance rather than just putting an app on their phone that forces something to happen. I think there's a collaboration that we need to have in this case,
yeah,
rather than, you know, sort of the adults forcing themselves on the youth.
Glenn, thank you so much for your call. I'm taking it back from you because we just got a minute to go. Jean Twenge, your thought on that?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point, that we do need to be working with teens. So the whole point of my book of iGen was to sum up not just the numerical data on 11 million young people, but also to listen what they had to say in open-ended surveys, in-depth interviews. And what they told me was they see the negative effects of the phone. Many of them see it every day. They say, when my friend is looking at her phone when I'm trying to talk to her, it hurts. They say that they know that it's not a great way to be happy. Many teens really like it when adults say, okay, we're going to put away our phones now, because they feel like it's mandatory and there's this peer pressure involved. So absolutely, that's exactly what we need to be doing, is start this conversation with teens.
Well, Casey Brown just sent me a tweet saying some of this sounds like what we heard in the 80s and 90s about kids watching too much TV. And to that point, I would say my answer is moderation in all things, perhaps, is one of the lessons to draw from this. Gene Twenge, professor of psychology at San Diego State University and author of iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Thank you so very much for joining us. It was great to have you on the show.
Thanks.
And listeners, let us know what you think. As always, go to RadioBoston.org and send us your comment, or, you know, I'm on Twitter at Radio Boston. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.